Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back. I'm Mark Bayshore. A troubling trend for Michigan schools. More Michigan school districts are feeling fiscal pressure. The Free Press's Lori Higgins reports today that 53 Michigan school districts had their credit ratings lowered through October. This is for calendar 2013 through last month. That is a 64% more downgrades than in all of calendar 2012, a problem that we have kept our eye on here on Current State, and we will continue to do. We want to thank Current State listeners who joined us at Schuler Books Eastwood Town Center last night. Lots of good ideas were in circulation, and we appreciate it. We're planning on more such gatherings soon. Coming up, meet Michigan State University's Rhodes Scholar candidate Craig Pearson, extraordinary young guy. We go out for some figure skating here, and we meet artist Chris Jordan, who has an extraordinary approach, a statistics-driven approach to creation. It is really an extraordinary exchange with Chris Jordan, who is coming to Michigan State. At the top of our program on Monday, Democratic gubernatorial candidate Mark Schauer called for Michigan to adopt the highest minimum wage in the country. Currently standing at $7.40 an hour, Mr. Schauer's recommended $9.25 an hour would surpass the top existing state rate, that's in Washington, by 6 cents. Mr. Schauer, describing the move as right, both economically and morally, says minimum wage earners deserve a raise. Meanwhile, Michigan's business community warns the wage hike could make the state less competitive in its efforts to attract more business and jobs. Well, here to make his case for the minimum wage hike and to talk about other issues, we welcome back to Current State Mark Schauer. How are you?
I am great. Thank you.
Great to have you back. Your plan would work over 3 years.
Yes.
Just explain the basics for us.
Well, Michigan's minimum wage is currently $7.40 an hour, which 17 states have minimum wages higher than ours. And just bottom line, minimum wage workers continue to lose ground. It's worth 20% less than the minimum wage at its peak in 1968. So, and that's bad for the economy, and that's bad for these families raising kids. And, you know, the face of the minimum wage is very different. You know, my first job as a kid, beyond having a paper route, was pumping gas and earning $2.65 an hour. Well, minimum wage earners are mostly adults. 85% of them are age 20 and over. 44% of minimum wage workers are working full-time. 55% are women, and many of those women are raising our children. So it is wrong and immoral and bad economics for parents working full-time and raising their children in poverty. We're better than that. But here's my plan. It's a very responsible, commonsensical plan. It would raise the minimum wage from $7.40 an hour over 3 years to $9.25 an hour, approximately getting us back to the purchasing power of the minimum wage in 1968. In year one, it would go to $8 an hour. Year two, $8.60 an hour. Year three, $9.25 an hour. And at that point, it would be tied to inflation. So as the price of milk or gasoline or groceries go up, the minimum wage would keep up with it. And, you know, MSU economist Dale Bellman was with me as I unveiled this plan on Monday, and Dr. Bellman's about to publish a book on the minimum wage, and his research shows that as people have a little bit more money in their pockets, they spend that in local businesses, that's good for the economy, and that's exactly why I'm making this proposal and making it one of my top priorities when I become governor.
Now, I'm sure you knew that critics would point to studies that suggest it could slow down job growth or eliminate existing jobs. How are you responding to those critics?
Well, it's the sky is falling. That's exactly what they've argued. I knew the Michigan State Chamber of Commerce would come out with that. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce always comes out with those same claims. I've been battling those claims since I was running a community action agency and running a Head Start back in the mid-'80s. It's not true. Data does not show that.
There is no connection, or is there a minor connection? You're denying that there is any connection at all?
Dr. Bellman, his research shows there is possibly a very, very small drop in unemployment, but that's compensated by growth in the economy as a result of people having more money to spend.
Mm-hmm. If you were elected next year, is there anything that could unfold economically that might get you to reconsider this call for a hike in the minimum wage?
I really don't think so. I mean, this is the right proposal now for a stagnating economy. I mean, one of the reasons, we have to look at the context. What Governor Snyder has done, his overriding economic philosophy is give a big corporate tax cut. That's sort of classic, supply-side trickle-down economics. And it hasn't worked. What's confounded that is he's raised taxes on retiree pensions, on parents raising children, and on these very same low-wage earners. Governor Snyder raised taxes on the working poor, on minimum wage earners. So what that's led to is the fourth worst unemployment rate in the country, the middle class shrinking, poverty rising in Michigan. So this is the right solution at a time where we have a stagnating economy. It will help speed economic growth in Michigan, but I think it's the fact that we tie this to inflation, tie future increases to inflation, is it will keep up, not lag, and not be a case where minimum wage earners are earning so little they don't have money to put into the economy.
We're talking with Democratic candidate for governor of Michigan, Mark Schauer. Transparency has become a hot topic as it relates to the Snyder administration. You tore into the governor for not disclosing the names of his Nerd Fund contributors after it was ended. He is saying that we need to find the right balance between the need for disclosure and freedom of speech. How do you respond to that? Does he have a point?
Wonder what that balance would be for Governor Snyder. I mean, this transparency governor has been anything but that. From his own Nerd Fund to the auto no fault reform proposal, where we still don't know have the information to rate what is in the Michigan Catastrophic Claims Fund and how those ratings are determined. And he's just candidly, trying to provide another giveaway to, in this special interest, in this case, the auto industry. But, I think sunshine is the best disinfectant. That's the best disinfectant for campaign finance as well. So I find it very curious that, the governor who's, is hiding behind million and billion dollar and corporate special interest donors to his Nerd Fund seems to be waffling on a very basic question of campaign finance disclosure.
You acknowledged having a fund similar to the Nerd Fund.
It was not similar to the Nerd Fund at all.
Years ago. Well, help us understand what you did have.
Yeah, the Schauer Community Fund was a very small fund that bought American flags for Eagle Scouts and school groups and funded activities like my annual NAACP at the Capitol, which is something I began after Republican Senator Phil Hoffman had initiated that proposal, who I succeeded in Jackson County. So it was a very small fund. We've released all of our records. Governor Snyder, if he would just release his records, I would be satisfied with that. We'd at least know, who paid for Rich Baird, his quote-unquote transformation manager, or part of Kevin Orr's salary, his emergency manager in Detroit. I was certainly not paying for governmental services. I was buying American flags.
You were a supporter of the Affordable Care Act during your term in the U.S. House. The ACA has, of course, had a very troubled rollout. Here in Michigan, a couple hundred thousand people are expected to lose their existing health insurance, contrary to what the president insisted. Have you had any second thoughts about Obamacare?
No, I have not. And, you know, I think we should be holding these insurance companies accountable for dropping people from their coverage. They would still have another year to continue these very basic policies. Apparently, they don't think it's profitable enough to do that. You know, what the Affordable Care Act is about is making sure people have policies that provide comprehensive coverage, that they can't be discriminated against based on pre-existing conditions. Women can't be charged more than men. Wellness care and preventative care is covered at no cost. Seniors see a reduction in their prescription costs. You know, what the insurance companies, I guess, continue to feel is that that's not profitable for them to do that. So, you know, the Affordable Care Act is the right thing to do for families that, you know, the leading cause of bankruptcy in America were medical bills. So, you know, it's unfortunate. I'm not happy at the problems that President Obama has had with the National Exchange. If Governor Snyder would have been effective in working with the legislature, we'd have a state exchange right now. And we would have Medicaid expansion starting in January rather than in April.
Are you concerned that your support of the ACA might cost you votes in the campaign, though?
No, I'm not. Look, I have always put doing the right thing ahead of worrying about vote counting.
How have you been preparing specifically for such a long campaign? I have to ask you that. We're still almost a year from Election Day. How are you preparing for that?
I eat right and I exercise every day and try to get enough sleep, which is not always easy. But, you know, I've been through these battles before. I mean, I ran in my congressional races in 2008 and 2010. They were the most expensive and hotly contested congressional races in the country. You know, I'm used to tough campaigns. This new district of 83 counties is a little bit bigger than what I've run in before, so spending a little bit more time in the car. But, you know, the response is, you know, fantastic. I, you know, was in Ann Arbor and Novi last night after being in Metro Detroit all weekend. The response is fabulous. People are ready for change. They're unhappy about school cuts and the pension tax and, you know, a struggling economy and tax on women's access to health care and domestic partner benefits for gay and state employees, things like the NERD fund and right to work. So I feel very encouraged and very confident with what's going on out there across the state, and people are ready for change.
All right. Mark Schauer is the Democratic candidate for governor of Michigan. Mark, thanks. We'll talk again.
Thank you.
Tonight, the MSU Department of Geography welcomes acclaimed artist and cultural activist Chris Jordan to the Payson Theater at Wharton Center. Jordan turns data into powerful art, including images made up of thousands of credit cards or cigarettes or Barbie dolls. His current project is called Running the Numbers, an American Self-Portrait. Jordan explains why data and statistics are the starting point for his work.
I'm interested in facing the difficult, frightening, enormous realities of the time we live in. And as a photographer, it's vexing and kind of impossible to go take photographs of these mass phenomena because it's all spread out over hundreds of thousands of different locations. You know, so there's nowhere you can go take a picture of all the trees that are cut down in the U.S. every year to make the paper for junk mail. Or, you know, the 210 billion plastic bottles we used last year in the United States. And so the only information we have to try to relate to those phenomena are these incomprehensibly gigantic statistics. And as a photographer, I was just thinking, like, I wish there was a Mount Everest of our garbage that I could go take a picture of, because then we would feel something. And we could, begin to relate to the problems in a different way. And yet that's impossible. And so that was kind of the inspiration behind creating these very large-scale digital images that contain hundreds of thousands of smaller photographs and actually attempt to depict the actual numbers of things that we consume and waste.
Can you describe one piece of work in your project and how it came about, if you have a favorite maybe, or one you're particularly proud of?
You know, there's one piece that every time I see it, it hits me again, the same way it did when I first made it, and that's a piece that I made called Prison Uniforms. And that piece it's a very large-scale digital artwork, 10 by 23 feet in size, that depicts 2.3 million folded prison uniforms, which is equal to the number of Americans incarcerated. And when I first made that image, you know, I pasted 2.3 million prison uniforms onto this massive canvas in Photoshop. And every time I have printed the image, I have made the prints and watched those long 10-foot-tall prints slowly come out of my printer depicting hundreds of thousands of uniforms, you know, each one representing one American in jail. And every single time I get to see that piece, it hits me again.
Why that one? Just because of the... why does that one resonate so much more than the others?
I think maybe it has something to do with the fact that it's about people. A lot of my work is about things we waste, you know, trees we cut down or plastic cups we use or whatever. And this one it depicts people. I haven't done a lot of those. And it's much harder, actually, to do a piece that fairly represents human beings. You know, I've wanted for a long time to do a piece that depicts the number of civilian people in Iraq who have died as a result of the Iraq War. You know, the best number is more than 1 million, and I just can't think of something that will honor them fairly. And so it's just a much more sensitive subject. And when I get one right, like prison uniforms, then it just every time I see it, it breaks my heart again.
Do you feel your work is having the desired impact?
Well, you know, it used to matter to me a lot to try and figure out if my work's making any difference. And I let go of that a while back because what I'm trying to do is something that's it's kind of essentially intuitive or ethereal in nature. You know, it's just a very different kind of work than maybe an activist who's raising money to buy computers to put in a science lab. You know, at the end of the day, they can say, we put 300 computers in science labs today, and, you know, I put my work out there, and it's really... The intention is to shift consciousness, and it's impossible to measure, and there are also lots and lots of other people who are working in, you know, trying to do the same thing, and hopefully it's adding up to something, but it's impossible to know. I just have to kind of keep doing the work and keep my eye on the subject.
Tell us about another piece of work here. You scanned a photo of a Vicodin pill, and you created an image comprised of 213,000 of these pills made to represent the number of hospital emergency room visits yearly in the United States attributed to the abuse and misuse of prescription painkillers and anti-anxiety medications. Tell us about how that unfolded.
Each one of the pieces that I do, the inspiration almost always comes from, I'm just reading, you know, I'm reading the news, and I read about a phenomenon that just breaks my heart. It just hits me in the chest. And that one did. You know, when I read those numbers, I had no idea that many people were suffering overdoses of prescription painkillers. And to me, it's just, there's profound meaning there. I think our culture is, I mean, there's a collective emotional burden that we're all carrying. And my astrologer friend Caroline Casey says the pressure comes down and it ruptures through the thinnest membranes. And so those 200,000 people are, you know, those are the thinnest membranes in our culture, but we're all bearing the same kind of cultural pressure, anxiety for what's happening in our world. And I read about a phenomenon like that, and it just it inspires me to do something. And so that piece, you know, I wanted to make it a spiral, the sort of spiraling effect of addiction and avoidance and denial. that our culture is in.
We're talking with photographer, visual artist Chris Jordan, who appears at the Paysant Theater at the Wharton Center at Michigan State University tonight. Are humans more unaware of these uncomfortable realities, or are we aware and unable or unwilling to confront them?
Well, that's a beautiful question. I mean, that just goes to the heart of it. I think we're all aware, other than, you know, the few people in places that don't have good internet access, but they don't need to be aware anyway because they're not consuming much. But I think us in the first world, we know. And, you know, Al Gore said this 15 years ago. He said, we know what's going on, we know what we should be doing, but we just aren't finding the collective will to do it. And I'm fascinated by that. It's not that we need information about solutions. Like, we have the solutions. The solutions are available to each one of us and to us, you know, collectively. It's just that we have to find the collective will to change. And so I think the last half of your question is the correct one, is that we're refusing to face it. Not because we're bad people, but because I think we're living in fear of what would happen if we faced the reality of our times. And I like to call it fear of sadness. I think we collectively live in fear of sadness. Like, if we allow ourselves to know on a heart level, you know, on a deep level, the extinction of species that's happening, and to really grok the destruction of the Amazon rainforest, and so on. I think, I mean, a friend of mine the other day said it really clearly. She said, I'm afraid if I start crying, I'll never stop.
There is a sense of alarm and immensity to your work. Do you ever have to distance yourself from this to keep putting one foot in front of the other? I mean, what encourages you?
Well, yeah, it's hard not to live on the pendulum, you know, swinging back and forth between hope and hopelessness and, you know, joy and despair. And what I'm really interested in is learning how to hold them both rather than focusing on, you know, feeling hope and then getting dragged over to hopelessness and then trying to drag myself back to hope. I want to learn how to live in the paradox of our time, which is to be simultaneously filled with hope and filled with hopelessness. And simultaneously filled with despair and horror and with wonderment and joy and love. Because the world is still a miracle and it's in a state of collapse. Those things are both true at the same time, and to hold them together, I mean, these kind of antithetical, conflicting truths, like, that's what I want to learn how to do.
Your work suggests a genuine alarm over modern society, 21st century consumer society. In addition to your art, do you actively discourage people from buying things they do not need?
Well, you sort of pointed out the challenging tightrope that I try to walk, because I'm much more interested in being an artist than I am an activist. I mean, first of all, discouraging people from using plastic bags and plastic straws and stuff like that, it usually doesn't work, and it's kind of annoying. And even if everybody did it, it wouldn't solve the much bigger problems. And so on one hand, you know, inviting somebody to become a vegetarian or something, it can be like a doorway into an interesting conversation, but I mean, I find the vast majority of all that kind of activism to be kind of preachy, and I don't want to tell people how to behave. You know, it doesn't work, and it's just disrespectful to other people's worldviews. But if I can help somebody see something that they didn't see before in a way that causes them to change their own behavior, then that feels valuable. And on a deeper level, what I really hope, what I really wish for my work, is that I can help people remember something that's built inside all of us, and that is to simply live in reverence of the incomprehensibly beautiful miracle our world is, and from there turn back toward our behaviors and take a look and say, you know, do I want to change? It just doesn't feel up to me to tell anybody how to behave.
Photographer, visual artist Chris Jordan visits the Paysant Theater at Michigan State University tonight. Chris Jordan, a pleasure talking to you. Thanks.
Oh, Mark, thanks so much for having me on, and I look forward to coming and visiting.
It's Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Wednesday means it's time for our Neighbors in Action segment, where Current State features people and organizations working to make our community a better place. Today we feature the Michigan Horse Welfare Coalition. The coalition helps feed horses with their hay bank and also works to save horses from abuse and neglect. Here to tell us more about the Michigan Horse Welfare Coalition, Jill Fritz, president of the organization. Hi, Jill.
Hi there.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
And joining us by phone is Jody Louth, vice president and rescue coordinator for the Michigan Horse Welfare Coalition. Jody, welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Sure. Jill, what are the main services you offer exactly?
Well, just as a little background, we got together in January 2010 with various equine stakeholders and horse rescuers throughout the state to talk about problems that horse owners were facing in the state with the economy, taking a crash, and people having problems feeding their animals. And we looked at what are the challenges facing horse owners and horses in Michigan. And we found a couple of key things were needed. Number one, financial assistance needed to be available to horse owners, just like food banks or pet food banks. We also found that there seemed to be a lack of education about responsible horse ownership in the state, and also education for law enforcement officers to understand what to look for with horse neglect or cruelty. And third, help with coordinating and helping horse rescues and sanctuaries across the state. So with that in mind, we put together a working plan to set up a hay bank based on what Oregon had done years ago, created a very successful hay bank, and also to help law enforcement by providing training and resources for them to investigate horse neglect and cruelty and to assist them if they needed to respond to large-scale cases.
They're large animals. I mean, that translates into some degree of expense. They're not inexpensive to adequately care for a horse.
Yes, right? It is. Yeah. It is expensive to have a horse. So as people found when the economy took a dive, that they were suddenly on very thin ice. So, yeah.
Jody, talk to us about who you typically serve.
Well, we serve both the public and law enforcement agencies, as Jill mentioned. We serve the public by offering a list of partner rescues on our website that the public can trust in terms of where to look if they would like to support a rescue organization, or if they would, if they need to rehome their horse. There's been a history of some rescues sprouting up in the state that don't always have the, you know, best interest of the horses in mind. So we thought providing this list to the public would be a good service for them. And all of the rescues on our list are 501c3 organizations and well-established. And then we also service, as Jill mentioned, law enforcement agencies. Before the coalition was founded, law enforcement officials really had nowhere to turn for help in cruelty and neglect cases, as most are just not equipped to handle horses. Mm-hmm. So we kind of offer like one-stop shopping for law enforcement officials. They can call us, and then we get the word out to our partner rescues. And, you know, we have sent horses, you know, from one neglect situation, for instance, they might get sent to three different rescues who have space and who has the ability to care for their particular needs.
Mm-hmm. Jill, how much does it cost to adequately care for a horse over the course of a year, let's say?
Well, it's hard to say. I mean, the average horse will eat, you know, depending on the quality of the hay, from a quarter to half a bale of hay a day, and it all depends on the horse prices, of the hay prices, and that can go up and down. Like there was a recent drought, so hay prices just went through the roof. But then on top of that, of course, you have regular veterinary care, hoof care, teeth care, things like that, and those are all things that we're able to help horse owners to provide
but
for their
horses. But it's easily in the hundreds.
Yes.
Into the thousands of dollars a year?
Jody can probably answer that better. But
how much is that, Jody?
Yeah, Yes, it is. My daughter is in Pony Club, and I believe we just calculated the cost, the annual cost for her horse alone, and it was, I think, around $1,400. So it's very expensive. And, you know, that's, I think, a message we would like to get out to the public as well. You know, horses right now, are you can get them pretty cheap, but you have to be aware that there are lots of costs involved with owning and caring for a horse, and you have to be prepared. And, you know, last year's drought really caught a lot of horse owners off guard, and they weren't prepared, did not have their hay situation figured out. And so we're urging people, you know, this winter, even though things look better, there was a much better hay yield this year, to you know, be prepared, think ahead, you know, have an emergency fund for in case something happens, you know, with your horse. I mean, we're right now assisting a gal who spent all of her money, you know, trying to save her horse, and now the horse needs to be humanely euthanized, so we're assisting her with that. So, you know, just plan ahead and be responsible.
We're talking with Jill Fritz of the Michigan Horse Welfare Coalition and Jody Louth, who is the rescue coordinator and vice president of the group here on Neighbors in Action. What are these horses' afflictions when you aid in abuse or neglect situations? Are we talking starvation? Do you encounter a lot of physical abuse cases?
In the cases so far, I have not seen specific physical abuse. For the most part, they are neglect. We see a lot of horses with very low body scores, emaciated, left with their hooves neglected. So we see mainly hoarding or people who are breeding irresponsibly without the means to care for the horses, or just neglecting them, mental health cases.
Jody, do you end up enlisting the support of veterinarians?
Yes, we do. We've worked with numerous veterinarians around the state. Most are more than happy to help us out. And, you know, we work with clinics. There's a clinic on the west side of the state that routinely offers low-cost gelding and euthanasia clinics, which is wonderful for the public to utilize.
How do you fund your group's activities?
We rely on donations from the public entirely. We're a 501c3 nonprofit organization, and I can't stress enough that we could not do this without donations from equestrian groups like the Highland Equestrian Conservancy, the Kensington Trail Riders, and many other trail rider groups. Donations at tack and feed events, or tack and feed stores, equine events, Michigan businesses and artists support us, authors, and individuals. And that's how we're able to fund our hay bank and our other resources.
And Jody, how can people find out more about your organization and get involved?
Well, the easiest way is to go to our website, which is www.michiganhorsewelfare.org. We also have a very active Facebook page, and they can sign up to volunteer on our website, and they can sign up for hay bank assistance, as well as they can help spread the word about our mission by, you know, downloading and printing our hay bank flyer and posting that in feed stores and such.
Yeah, this hay bank is obviously an important piece of the whole puzzle here. That is there's an online component to this as well, Jill?
Yes, it is. You can go right to MichiganHorseWelfare.org, and you'll see a form to apply for hay bank assistance, and all the criteria are listed right there on the site.
Very good. We want to thank both of you for opening our eyes to a very interesting organization and problem in Michigan. Jill Fritz is the president of the Michigan Horse Welfare Coalition. Jody Louth is the vice president and rescue coordinator. Thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We could always use more nominations, and we know that there are great people and organizations out there doing excellent work. We just don't know about them here on Current State. Please help us out and send us an email about these great nonprofits for our Neighbors in Action segment. It happens every Wednesday. Our email address, currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line and tell us why you think they should be featured for the great work they do. This weekend, Michigan State University senior Craig Pearson will interview for a Rhodes Scholarship. If he's chosen, Pearson would become MSU's 17th Rhodes Scholar. Current State Scott Pohl talked with Pearson about what it takes to become a Rhodes Scholar and what it would mean to his career if the committee decides to send him to Oxford.
They fund 2 to 3 years of graduate study in any program at Oxford University. And for me, that would mean working toward a PhD. So what I'm really excited about is the opportunity to enter an interdisciplinary neuroscience PhD program. But beyond that, I mean, Oxford really, and the Rhodes really is about the community of scholars. So it's these 32 students from the United States and then students from other countries around the world all get together in this community. And, you know, they're studying all kinds of different disciplines and they're doing different programs. And to be around, you know, high achieving, high energy, really interesting people, that's what I've heard is the greatest part of the experience.
All right. Now, while we're talking, I'm going to recount for our listeners at least a portion of your resume, which is frankly mind-boggling to someone such as me with a simple bachelor's degree. You're in the MSU Honors College. You're a senior majoring in neuroscience, biochemistry, and molecular biology in the College of Natural Science and English in the College of Arts and Letters. So you're going to have to explain that to me. What's up with doing all of that at the same time here at MSU?
Well, they happen one at a time. I didn't march in here as a freshman with all three in my back pocket. For me, it started out with a biochemistry. I mean, that was something I loved in high school. It's that intersection between chemistry and biology. On the scale of you know, science from, you know, micro to macro, biochemistry deals with proteins and it's, you know, molecular circuits and it's sensory pathways. And that to me is really interesting. And from there, you know, it just built one upon the other. I decided to take a few English classes just because I love literature and the curriculum here is so fantastic. I just couldn't stop. And so that's where English happened. And neuroscience is actually a pretty new degree here for undergraduates. I think maybe 1 or 2 years ago they introduced it as a major. And so I gobbled it right up. I mean, I had taken a neurobiology class as a sophomore, and that was in the fall. And then in the spring they introduced this new major. So I thought, this is perfect. This is what I want to do. Neuroscience is, you know, the coolest field to me. And to be able to integrate all three of those majors now as a senior looking back, it really has allowed me to take a truly diverse and unique curriculum here at MSU. So I'm really happy to be able to do all of them.
Are you a 4-year senior or is this more than 4 years in your case?
4 years. Can you believe it?
Oh my gosh.
Thanks, Honors College.
Now you're from Bloomfield Hills. And while you were in high school, you did volunteer work working with students with visual impairments. I'd like to know more about that and whether that led to your interest in neuroscience or if the reverse is maybe the case.
Yeah, I had this opportunity in high school to do outreach work at a school that had students with visual disabilities, cognitive disabilities, and that really was a formative moment for me in terms of figuring out what I wanted to do with my life. I had opportunities to work directly with these students, to work with their teachers, and to see the impact, you know, that was being made in this school. I remember there was one day we were doing a sort of a baking day. You know, I was working in the youngest classroom. Most of the kids in this classroom were, you know, 5 or 6 years old. They all had cognitive and visual disabilities. And we were doing baking, and I remember we were putting the ingredients into the bowl and there was this one kid who couldn't see. And so I was sort of waving the cinnamon around in front of his face and he just lit up and it was this amazing response. And I thought, wow, you know, we can really make a difference. And it's just thinking about it in different ways. And so that has led to a lot of the work that I've done here. You know, I've worked at the clinical center at MSU in the neuro-ophthalmology unit where people come in and they can't see out of one eye or they're seeing double. And we have to figure out, you know, what's wrong? How can we fix this?
Okay, so on Friday, you're going to be in Chicago interviewing for a Rhodes Scholarship. What do you know about the interview? How long might it last? What are they looking for? Are you prepared in any fashion? Do they prepare you in any fashion for the interview?
Yeah, I mean, the Rhodes is sort of a unique interview. They bring you in on Friday, and they have sort of a coffee hour, a reception where you get to meet the other applicants. For me this year in the Chicago region, they're going to be 13, including me. And there are, I think, 6 or 7 judges on the committee. And so we all get to interact. It's this moment for you to kind of have a you know, low-key social time just to get to know everybody and become familiar. So that I'm really looking forward to. I've never had that as part of an interview before. And then on Saturday morning, you get a time slot for your interview, and it's just 25 minutes. You sit down with the committee, and they ask you about, you know, your experiences and what you want to do. And from that, you know, they can call people back for additional questions, but they make their decision right on the day. So I'll know by Saturday whether I'm a Rhodes Scholar or not.
How does one become nominated for a Rhodes Scholarship?
It's quite a process. It starts with putting in an application to MSU. They have an internal review process, and in order to go out to the national competition, you have to receive a nomination from your institution. And each school does it differently, but with MSU, you apply internally through the National and International Fellowships and Scholarships Board, I guess, the committee there. And so I went through that in August. I turned in my application, and they reviewed it. We went for an interview in September, and I received the nomination. And so then they really helped me put together, you know, the final touches and prepare for the interview. And that's where I am today.
Now, I understand that 32 altogether are chosen from the United States. And you say 13 will be at the Chicago region or whatever you might call it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I assume there are others. How do they narrow it down to 32 if you're told on Saturday whether you're in or not? Do they have just a certain number of slots for each region? How does that work?
Yeah, each region gets two slots. So I believe there are 16 regions. I think Chicago is District 10. And they bring in as many as they have the capacity for. I think it's, you know, around 11 to 14 or 15 per region. And they have two spots to fill. So they bring their chosen applicants in, and they decide on those 2 days, you know, which two they want to offer the scholarship.
So if you're chosen on Saturday, you'll start when? Next fall?
Yes.
And you'll be there for 2 or 3 years if you go to Oxford.
Yeah, hopefully longer. the funding goes to, and they can extend it to a third year. But I really want to work toward a doctorate. And so that typically is 3 to 4 years in England.
Craig Pearson is a nominee for a Rhodes Scholarship. He'll interview in Chicago Friday and Saturday, and we'll know by the end of the weekend whether he's won. Good luck to you.
Thank you.
For Current State, this is Scott Pohl.
It's Current State. I'm Mark Bayshore. The road to the 22nd Winter Olympics Games in Sochi, Russia, runs through East Lansing this week. Beginning today, the city plays host to nearly 250 athletes competing in the 2014 Midwestern Sectional Figure Skating Championships. The event is a first for the Lansing area. Skaters who place well enough here will advance to the U.S. Figure Skating Championships in Boston this January. For decades, the national title has been a springboard for athletes competing for Olympic gold. Current State's Kevin Lavery met up with Megan Ziemer at the venue, Suburban Ice, near the MSU campus. Ziemer is manager of sports events for the Greater Lansing Sports Authority and a co-chair of the event.
We have a pretty good partnership, the Greater Lansing Sports Authority, along with Suburban Ice East Lansing and the Lansing Skating Club, and we came together a few years ago after we hosted the Junior Championships back in 2011 and decided to bid on hosting another event, and we bid on the sectional event as well as the regional championships, and we were awarded Midwestern Sectionals.
This is the U.S. Figure Skating Association that makes the determination?
That's correct.
And what did they see here at this venue that sold them on the idea of coming to East Lansing?
I think that we have a strong LOC. LOC is a local organizing committee. The partnership between the Greater Lansing Sports Authority along with Suburban Ice and the Lansing Skating Club, we have a unique partnership where all three of us come together to host the event. Unlike other events where typically it's just the club that hosts the event, we have a strong partnership and we're all in this together to bring the event.
Explain the different levels of competition, Megan. This is the Midwestern Sectional, but how is the U.S. Figure Skating Association set up?
These kids actually have, this is their second qualifying competition in the season. They start at regionals. They come from three different regionals. Then they filter into the sectional event, which is the Midwestern Sectional Championships that we're hosting. Their levels from juvenile all the way up through senior level will be hosting the singles, men and women's, along with the dancers and the pairs teams.
So what is the age range then?
That's a tough question because they can kind of range. I think we have some kids as young as 9, 10, 11, all the way up to in their early 20s.
We have six local athletes from this area. Can you tell us a bit about their background?
We do have six local athletes. We have Brayden Miller, who will be competing at the juvenile level, as well as her sister Hannah Miller, who will be competing at the senior level. We have Ivan Makoff, who will be competing at intermediate men. Sammy Parks will be competing at intermediate men along with Ivan, as well as competing juvenile pairs with Devin Pasco. And then we have Maeve Pasco, who will be competing with her partner Micah at the novice dance level.
Certainly, we in this area have heard of Hannah Miller and Ivan Makoff because the two of them went to the U.S. National Figure Skating Championship almost a year ago in Omaha. Hannah placed 8th, Yvonne placed 12th, so that's their standings.
Correct. You know your skating background, that's for sure. Yes, they had a very successful season last year, and we hope to see them advance as well as some of our other local skaters this year.
Now, there will be how many people from across the country or across the Midwest certainly here?
We will be hosting 234 skaters representing 22 different states across the Midwest, along with the 50 officials that we'll be hosting, along with all of the coaches and the families and parents and all of that.
Is there something to be said about home ice for the six mid-Michigan competitors?
I think it's always exciting when you get to skate at your home ice and have your local support of your club and your family and friends that are able to come out, and it's kind of your time to shine in your local, you know, your home club. So I do think that there is the local home club advantage, home ice advantage, if you will, but I also do think that it adds that little bit of nerves as well to each and every one of them.
And about how many people, Megan, do we think will be coming to East Lansing over the course of this week? And is this really an opportunity for this region to show other people who come here from the Midwest that this community really is a great sports venue, that we have a sports reputation here?
I can't tell you the exact number of people. Like I said, we'll have 234 competitors, and when you factor in their family and friends, plus their coaches, we're going to be well over 1,000, maybe a couple thousand, 2,500 that we'll get here. And that's just kind of off the top of my head, not to mention the locals that will come out just to support the event. Michigan is a very strong skating community as a whole, and we are fortunate enough that here in Lansing, we are a very, very strong ice community as well.
This is the Midwestern sectional, but there are also two other events happening on different coasts at the same time. Can you speak a bit about what's happening there and how those three events eventually lead to the national championship, which is in January in Boston?
At the same time, Eastern sectionals will be going on as well as the Pacific Coast, California, and then I believe in Washington or Virginia area, they're hosting the Eastern sectional. So yes, they are all going on at the same time, and all of the competitors will then advance on to Boston to compete for the national championship.
So just because you are a competitive skater in East Lansing and you're looking around the rink and eyeing your competition doesn't mean you've got it made if you do well here, because you've got people on both coasts who are chasing after you.
Yes, that's correct. Fortunate for these skaters, we are the toughest sectional, so this is kind of a glimpse of what their competition is out there. But you're right, once they get to Boston, it's going to be another step.
What makes us the toughest sectional?
Midwestern sectional is a very strong skating body as far as the different clubs that are represented, so.
Have you had much opportunity to meet with and talk to our six local athletes? What are they all about? What do they tell you about their outlook about skating and what all that means to them?
I personally have not had the opportunity to talk to each and every one individually. I was a former figure skating coach here in Lansing, so I did get to follow them a little bit closer when I was coaching. I think all of them are, like I said before, very, very excited to be skating here in their hometown. I think they're all nervous, just like any competitor will be going into a big event like this, but I think they're just excited and ready to get it going.
So as a former coach, what will the judges be looking for? And I realize that's a broad topic, but is there a particular je ne sais quoi when you're out on the ice that the judges are really looking for?
With the judging system that we utilize for this event, it's the international judging system, and so it's all point-based and base value and GOEs and all sorts of good stuff like that. So as far as what the judges are looking for, they have kind of a set parameter of what the program components are that each of the competitors have submitted. So they each have something different that they're looking for. But is it, you know, the prettiest dress or the best hair? No, it's solely based on their expertise as a skater. So.
So what is the timeline for this event this week here in East Lansing beginning today?
Today we will kick off the first event, and we'll be running events from 7:30 Wednesday morning till about 10 o'clock every night. And then we end on Saturday evening at about 5:30. We'll be crowning championships throughout the event. We'll be crowning some Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
Megan Ziemer is the manager of sports events for the Greater Lansing Sports Authority. Megan, thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for coming out.
For Current State, I'm Kevin Lavery.
And that's our show for today. Coming up Thursday on Current State, we speak with filmmaker Christine Vachon. Also, can diverse communities be cohesive communities? New research suggests that ideal may not be achievable. Find out more Thursday on Current State. We want to offer a quick thank you to all of the Current State listeners who joined us at Schuler Books Eastwood Town Center last night. We heard a lot of good ideas and great feedback. They were all in circulation last night. We all enjoyed ourselves, and we appreciate it a lot. It's our second get-together with Current State listeners out and about, and we're planning on more such gatherings here soon. In the meantime, you can reach us via email anytime, currentstate@wkar.org. Follow us on Twitter @KARCurrentState. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Worf. Joe Lindstroth is our producer. Thanks also to producers Kevin Lavery, Melissa Benmark, Emmanuel Berry, and Scott Pohl. Also thanks to Aaron Young for engineering and to Gabriella Saldivia for production assistance. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks for listening. It's Current State on WKAR.